Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to investing and saving money, a lot of us seek the advice of professionals to make and grow investments. Spending money is another thing, from buying groceries to splashing out on a car. Spending is more habitual, immediate, intuitive even, and we rarely feel better about it afterward. So what are we doing wrong? Elizabeth Dunn and Michael Norton are two rising stars in the field of behavioral science. They're co-authors of the book Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. And the book presents new research that upends the old axiom, money can't buy happiness, proposing that if it can't, you must not be spending it right. The book is now out in paperback. And Elizabeth Dunn, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Your book is broken down into five key principles to teach us happier spending. Let's go through these. The first principle is buy experiences. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, the idea here is that people consistently get more happiness from buying experiences like trips and concerts and special meals than from buying material things, from couches all the way up to houses.
But trips and concerts and meals, though exciting and adventurous, can also be expensive, right? What's the difference?
Well, they're expensive often, and they tend to feel frivolous, right? Because you buy a couch, you're going to have that for 10 years. You buy a vacation, it's over in a week. But ironically, research suggests that the pleasure of that experience can actually last longer than the pleasure that we get from, say, something long-lasting like a couch. The thing is that experiences tend to bring us closer to other people in a way that material things don't. And experiences also make good stories. You're liked more if you talk about your experiential purchases than if you talk about your material purchases. So over time, experiences actually seem to provide higher returns in terms of happiness than material things.
And experiences like what? Going for a walk even? Going to a movie?
Well, going for a walk is a nice, cheap experience, but often we can use money to buy an even better experience, you know, going for a walk as part of an African safari, for example, or, you know, spending less money, but say, going to a movie, going out to dinner with a friend. Often we make trade-offs. You know, I've had friends who said to me, oh, well, I really can't go out at all for a month because I'm trying to save money to buy a new car, for example. And I actually think that that's not necessarily a good trade-off. I think although we feel like buying experiences might be a sort of waste of money, in fact, it seems to be one of the best uses of money in terms of delivering long-term happiness.
How about these big purchases, though, that adults make? One, of course, that people go through is buying a house, certainly an experience, but any data on how that stacks up emotionally?
Well, amazingly, even though buying a house is kind of like the quintessential aspect of the American dream, it turns out that homeownership really doesn't do much for our happiness. There's not a big difference between homeowners and renters in terms of happiness. Once you control for other sort of important variables like income, what you see is that homeowners weigh a little more. They're about 7 pounds heavier than renters on average, but they're not any happier. So it suggests then that, you know, putting all of our money into a home, particularly when that means, say, not being able to go to movies with your friends because you're house poor, you've put all your money into your house, well, that might not be such a great trade-off when it comes to happiness.
Okay, let's move on to the second principle to happier spending. Make it a treat. Now, what does that mean?
Well, this idea was actually inspired for us in part by comedian Sarah Silverman.
Oh, she's from New Hampshire.
I know. And she's a favorite of mine. And she has a saying, make it a treat, that she tells all of her comedy writers. So she finds that, you know, her comedy writers on her television shows that she's worked on want to indulge in all kinds of really gross jokes. Mm-hmm. But she says, no, you have to make these gross jokes a treat. You can't use them constantly, or they're no longer as funny. They don't deliver this kind of emotional punch. And the same turns out to be true with our spending. If we always indulge in things we like, you know, not just gross jokes, say, but lattes or fancy smoothies or whatever, those things that, you know, should be a treat tend to kind of fade into the background, and we start to indulge in this sort of habitual spending that no longer provides us with as much happiness. So we would argue that people should turn their favorite things back into treats by actually having them a little less often.
Okay. You also write about companies being able to do that too, transforming products to seem more like a treat, like Charmin toilet paper?
Yeah, and you wouldn't, I mean, most of us don't think of toilet paper as a treat, but Charmin actually had a remarkable campaign where they did something called Potty Palooza, where they planted these luxury porta potties in unexpected places, like at sporting events where you expect to find just horrible, gross porta potties. They put in this amazing luxury porta potty complete with television and beautiful hardwood floors and skylights, so that this experience of kind of waste management at public events actually became a treat, a kind of special experience. And so, you know, we would argue if Charmin can do it, anybody can do it. If we can turn toilet paper back into a treat, we can turn just about anything into something that's actually an opportunity for happiness rather than just a habit.
Elizabeth Dunn is with us. She's Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia and co-author of the book Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. It's out now in paperback. All right, let's get on to the third principle, buy time. How does one buy time?
So this is one that's near and dear to my heart. And the idea here is that when you pull out your wallet, you should stop and ask yourself, how will this purchase change the way I spend my time? And I would argue that many of our purchases, things like a new pair of shoes or a really nice purse, have little bearing at all on how we spend our time. And so I would suggest that purchases that are not going to affect our time may not be worth our time. And so instead, I would suggest that people focus on using their money in ways that will actually improve the minutes and hours of their daily life.
All right, what's an example of that?
Well, I think a great example is a dog. So if you're deciding between buying a dog versus buying a goldfish, the goldfish is clearly the cheaper option. It requires a lot less of your time. But a dog, buying a dog and putting all that money into having a dog, will change the way you spend your time. So you're basically committing yourself to spending lots of time, you know, walking the dog outside, which we know is good for your happiness, connecting with, you know, neighbors who, you know, have dogs who your dog runs up and sniffs, another thing that's good for happiness. So having a dog fundamentally alters the way you spend your time in ways that we know are actually good for your happiness.
Okay, so all of those mere minutes I could spend admiring those shoes on my feet doesn't mean much of anything?
Well, you know, I don't think we should completely discount that, right? So as long as you really make those shoes a treat and continue to appreciate them, then that's great. But often many of our purchases do sort of fade into the background and they don't really change the way you're spending your time. Now, if you don't have a pair of shoes, so you can't go outside because you have no shoes, then those shoes are going to make a difference in the way you spend your time. But buying that 12th pair of high heels is not going to change whether you're able to, you know, go out with friends on a Friday night.
Number four on your list of principles to spend more happily is pay now, consume later, the opposite of our credit-driven consumption market. So what does that mean? Avoid the impulse buy?
Well, the idea here is that we basically want people to do exactly the opposite of what they normally do. So very standard consumption pattern in modern life is that we, you know, get whatever we want right away and often pay for it much later. And we suggest people should do the exact opposite. So pay up front and delay consumption. And the idea here is that this way you get the pain of paying out of the way up front, which is good because it can kind of restrain our spending by making payment painful in the moment. That can keep us from overspending. And then by delaying consumption, we can reap a lot of free pleasure in the form of anticipation.
Let's just go back to the example of shoes, shall we? Rather than
sure,
putting
let's stick with shoes.
Rather than putting it on a credit card, it makes me think of, you know, what I used to do as a teenager. If I love something, I'd put it on layaway. I'd pay for it first and then have it.
Yeah, you know, layaway is a great old school happiness intervention. So if you pay for something first, then, you know, all the while as you're sort of making those payments, you know that something good is coming to you in the future. And that turns out to be really important because the future has an emotional power over us that the past simply doesn't. You know, you think the past and the future should be emotionally equivalent, but research shows they're not. We care about what's coming in the future. So if something good like that pair of shoes is coming to you in the future, that's going to provide you with more pleasure than if you already got those shoes in the past. So anticipation is actually this really potent form of pleasure that I think we often overlook in making spending decisions.
Wow. Elizabeth, your final principle to happier spending is to invest in others. What does the research say about how this works?
Well, the research suggests that instead of spending money on yourself, you can actually get more happiness by using it to benefit other people, whether that means donating money to a charity that you care about or just treating a friend to dinner.
What's an example of investing in others that doesn't necessarily mean a huge expenditure?
Well, I think the most remarkable finding from our work is that spending as little as $5 on a given day on somebody else can make a difference for our own happiness. And in fact, remarkably, we see this effect emerge all over the world. So we've conducted experiments not only in Canada and the United States, but also in places like India, Uganda, and South Africa. And what we see is that in some of these countries where people are really struggling to meet their own basic needs, we still find that people experience greater happiness when they use their money to benefit somebody else. So, for example, one participant in Canada told us about, you know, treating her mom to, I think, a scarf that she bought at the mall, while people in Uganda told us about things like buying malaria medication for a friend who was dying. And, you know, on the surface, these just seem like so different that how could we possibly see equivalent effects? And yet what we see in both countries is that people are getting more happiness when they're using their money to benefit somebody else.
Has the way that you spend changed since putting this book together?
Absolutely. So for one thing, I definitely donate more money to charity now. But I also feel more free to spend money on in certain areas of my life. So, for example, I actually had a baby about a year and a half ago, and he was the worst sleeper ever. He would only sleep in our arms. And so we finally paid somebody called a night doula an incredible amount of money to come and stay up with him all night for two nights, and she taught him how to sleep. Now, this amount of money that we spent, I couldn't have justified to myself before writing this book. But in writing this book, I really realized if you can spend money in a way that will alter the way you spend your time, that is happy money. And so when we paid this night doula, she changed the way that we spent the hours of 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. So we were able, my husband and I were actually able to return to our own bed, sleep in our bed, and not be holding an infant all night. And so that was probably some of the best money that I've ever spent. And I think I felt free to do so partly because of this research that we've done.
Elizabeth Dunn, thank you. Feels like time well spent.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Dunn, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. She is co-author with Michael Norton of the Harvard Business School of the book Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. It is now out on paperback, and you'll find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, then, spending the right way can lead to a happier life. Something else that contributes to happiness? Hobbies. Word of Mouth continues with the story of a 94-year-old woman who finds peace in an unexpected place, the mad clatter of a candlepin bowling alley. That's after the break. Stay with us.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ryan Family Amusements is a bowling alley in downtown Falmouth, Massachusetts, that opens at 9 o'clock in the morning. On Wednesdays, that is not quite early enough. That's the day senior league bowlers start crowding the door at 8:30, all ready for their weekly games. They come for the competition and the company. Nancy Klinginer brings us the story of one veteran who may be bowling her last season.
Walking into the Candlepin Bowling Alley in downtown Falmouth is kind of like walking into a time capsule. Seriously, this place could be from the 1960s or 70s. In fact, the machines that set up the pins are from the 60s. But time goes on here like anywhere else. Ask Nellie Kenyon. She just had a birthday.
94.
Congratulations.
Too many, a big number.
You look great.
Thank you.
Nellie does look great. If you met her, you'd probably think she was 20 years younger than she is. She's really well put together, too. Neat and tailored. She wears nice earrings and coordinated outfits. Nellie's the veteran of the senior league. They bowl every Wednesday morning in the off-season, from Labor Day to Memorial Day.
How's it going today, Nellie?
So-so.
Yeah, what does that mean?
I'm going along with my average, which is not very good. When I started, I used to be around a 92. Now I'm a 78 average. I got a hip that needs replacement for the third time. And I'm too old to have it done, period. I refuse to have another surgery at this age. I'm just too old. But anyway, I'm here, and I'm the last survivor. This league, when I started here 35 years ago, these 12 lanes were filled, and we had six on some teams.
Today, they're only using half the lanes, and most teams have just three people.
And I'm the last survivor. There's not one person left that was in that league except me.
This bowling alley is managed by Ryan Family Amusements, and it's all candlepin. Candlepin bowling is a New England thing. You use a smaller ball than regular bowling. It's about the size of a bocce ball. The pins are smaller, lighter, and straight. You throw three times instead of twice, and the pins you knock over stay in the lane. They call that playing the deadwood. When Nellie approaches the lane, she stands upright and squares herself off. She doesn't hesitate before she throws the ball. Sometimes she leaves her arm extended long after the ball is gone, like she's willing it where to go. Other times, she puts her hands on her hips, like she's exasperated. She keeps watch as the ball goes down the lane, which, to be honest, takes a little while with Nellie's ball. She doesn't throw as fast as she used to. She still pays close attention to the scores, her own score, her teammates, her opponents. And she gets all excited when her teammate Ralph bowls a terrific game, 140. That's about 50 points higher than he usually bowls these days. Nellie has kept on bowling, even as she's cut back on other things she loves, like golf. But she's not sure how much longer she can do it.
I think this is my last year. I don't think I'm coming back next year. On account of the hip.
Nellie's only been bowling candlepin for 35 years. But she's been bowling a lot longer than that. She bowled growing up in Bridgewater. In the 1950s, she was a young mom. Her husband died of a heart attack at 40. She was left with three kids. The oldest was seven. The youngest was 3 months old.
And the girls, you know, felt sorry for me, my friend, my neighbors. And so they would come down every day, and we'd go walking with our babies. And they got me to go bowling.
Nellie supported her family waitressing and selling real estate. In the 1970s, she married again. She and her second husband, Charlie, moved to Falmouth in 1979.
Everybody was gone home. So we took a walk down the beach that night, and we ran into this other couple. And I says, "What do you do now here?" She says, "Well, we're starting bowling tomorrow."
Nellie and Charlie showed up the next day and started bowling twice a week. They bowled together for 13 years until Charlie died. That was 22 years ago. But Nellie stayed with the senior league and Wednesday morning bowling. Being the league's veteran means she's lost a lot of friends along the way. Earlier this season, Nellie's teammate Barbara started losing weight, and she was a slim woman to begin with. Barbara went to Boston for a checkup and was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. She stopped coming to bowling on Wednesday mornings. Nellie tried, but couldn't reach her on the phone.
And I finally sent her a card, and I wrote on it, "I wish you'd come and visit with us." I says, "We miss you." I says, "Come and at least, you know, visit with us," I says, "because you've been a part of us for so many years." And she wrote me a letter, and I'll let you read it. I'll never part with that letter. "Dear Nellie, thank you for your thoughtful card and note. It's nice to know that my bowling buddies care. There is no cure for ALS, and I have accepted my situation. I am now under the care of hospice and will most likely only be at home for a few more days. I am at peace with God and my family. At these last stages of my disease, I only want to be with family. Keep bowling as long as you can. Nellie, Ralph, and Barbara were a great team, and I miss the sport and most especially the people." Wasn't that a lovely note?
Yeah.
breaks my heart. It really does. Because she's bowled with us for years. And she bowled 5 weeks before she died.
It's another Wednesday morning, so of course Nellie's back at the bowling alley.
Janet, are you going to bowl with us steady next year?
But this week, she's talking about what will happen in the fall when the league starts up again.
I had a cortisone shot, you know. That's why I do feel better.
So it looks like you're going to keep on bowling, huh?
Well, it's a long way to September. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But if I feel like this, I will bowl because I really enjoy it.
Nellie's taking her friend Barbara's advice to keep bowling as long as she can. In Falmouth, Massachusetts, I'm Nancy Klingener.
For many students across New Hampshire, the school year ends next week. So, parents, are you prepared? When Word of Mouth continues, from local makerspaces to tools for tinkering, some easy and creative ways to keep your child occupied this summer. That's after the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Summer is nearly here, and while kids count the days till the end of the school year, many parents are fretting over how to keep their kids occupied over the next few months. For those looking for ways to get kids off their screens this summer, Jessica Leahy is with us. Her article for the Motherload blog offers a, quote, big pile of fantastic ideas to get kids outside making and doing this summer. Jessica writes about education and parenting for the New York Times, The Atlantic, and on her JessicaLeahy.com blog. Jessica, so great you could be with us.
Thank you.
Okay, so for many parents across New Hampshire, school gets out next week. Where should they start?
The first place I think they should start is with giving kids some serious downtime once school is out. I'm not a fan of scheduling kids up over the summer. And while I've got some suggestions about things kids can do, I kind of hope that you'll present these ideas and let them lie on the table and let kids pick them up for themselves.
In their own due time.
In their own due time. Let them discover them as if they came up with the idea themselves.
Okay, so how about what's around town? I know you worked with a librarian on putting together your list. Are libraries in small New Hampshire's town generally active?
Libraries in New Hampshire in particular are very, very active. They bring speakers in. They have group projects for kids. Really get in touch with your librarian. And if they're not doing something for kids this summer, suggest leading a program. Some of the suggestions I have are really easy to implement with very little money and with just a couple of kids.
And I know STEM education is something that you say libraries are even ahead of the curve on.
They are way ahead of the curve. Judy Russell, the librarian in my town, Lyme, New Hampshire, she came up with just some great resources. If you go online and look at the makerspaces, they have great resources and maps so that you can find local programs and find spaces to do some of these projects.
All right, makerspaces. Can you give us a little?
Makerspaces are fantastic. They are staffed by people who are experienced with the materials and the technology to do everything from 3D printing to, you know, making a geodesic dome out of rolled up newspaper. And the make people, they're sort of a large organization across the country, are really enthusiastic about getting kids involved in STEM education and integrating arts and design as well into STEM with this new acronym STEAM.
All right. Now, you have a couple of books in front of you. Are those guides for our summer fun?
Well, I brought three books with me. The first book I brought with me is, I have to say, my favorite. It's called Unbored, and it's by Joshua Glenn and Elizabeth Foy Larson. It's really aimed at kids. This is the book that my 10-year-old tends to go to first because it's accessible to him. It even teaches kids at the very beginning how to tell their parents just to lay off and let them have some time and let them have some space and to not get too involved in their stuff.
Should we just open a page and see what's
there? Sure, let's just see what we can find here. Here we have Rocking Out, How to Create create your own band and and how to create your own sound. And it actually talks about different theories of how to, you know, what you can do with an amp, what you can do with a microphone, how you can set up your own practice schedule and space, and how to record your practices, which is something that just about everybody can do now that they have, you know, everything from smartphones to, you know, the ability to get on a laptop.
All right. That book is called Unbored, and we will have a list of all of the books that Jessica mentions today at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. What else have you got there?
I have Gever Tully's 50 Dangerous Things You Should Let Your Kids Do. Gever Tully is he's well known for his TED Talk about five dangerous things you should let your kids do. And, you know, the usual suspects are fire and whittling. You know, get a kid a pocket knife and teach them how to whittle. Don't get a kid a pocket knife and just send them out in the backyard. Show them about whittling and cutting away from your hand and how to use it safely. But Gever has, in this book, he has, in 50 Dangerous Things, he has a bunch of fun things for kids to do. Everything from how to properly light a fire to how to make your own slingshot.
I see a slingshot on the cover.
Yep.
Is that something that would make a lot of, I mean, you write about parenting a lot. Would it make your helicopter parent quiver?
Well, I have to tell you, I was at my parents' house last weekend and I gave this book to my dad, who grew up in southern Indiana and has some harrowing tales about all the kind of mischief that he's gotten into. And some of this is not going to upset helicopter parents at all, because there are things like driving a nail, which of course can be a little nerve-wracking the first time you watch your kid grab a hammer and whack a nail into a board. But some of them are things like go to the dump and, you know, burn things with a magnifying glass. It's not exactly high stakes terror and risk here.
Now, you have a couple of kids, different ages. Mm-hmm. So do you try and gauge some of these activities and books per child?
My kids have a pretty good sense of safety. Some kids, you really need to know your own kids. Some kids are much bigger risk takers than other kids. I tend to have fairly careful kids. And when I, you know, hand them some matches and tell them we're going to cook outside in an hour, could they please get the fire ready? We've talked about what that means then. And my younger son, actually, that's his favorite responsibility. He says, okay, what time are we eating? Okay, I need to plan about 90 minutes in advance so the wood will get burned to a certain level. And I send that 10-year-old outside with the matches, and he goes and gets the wood off the, you know, off of the pile. He knows exactly what needs to be done. But I didn't just send him out the first time to do that. I taught him how to do it. I was with him.
How about the other book you've got here?
The final book I have is really more for parents. It's The Best of Make, The Best of 75 Projects from the Pages of Make. And Make has a magazine, aptly named Make Magazine. They also are the people involved in the maker spaces. They have a lot of projects in here. Some of the really fun ones are how to make a little robot mouse out of a computer mouse. So some of these obviously require a little bit of how-to expertise, but it explains everything in here. There's some electronics. There's how to modify technology for kids who are too young for a mouse. Some of them are really, really hard to do. Some of them, not so much. And at the building your robot mouse, I thought that would be a little bit challenging. And my 10-year-old started to look at the instructions for that. And he said, I can do this. And there are some projects that, you know, you may need to help with. And that's great. You know, schedule it for a time that you guys can work together. And that's some of the most fun stuff you can do with your kids.
I look at Make Magazine and I think of popular mechanics that my dad used to have around. There seems to be a kind of daddish vibe to a lot of these Make magazines. I mean, am I just imagining that?
No, you are not imagining that. I mentioned my column in the New York Times is called The Parent Teacher Conference. And in that last column, I specifically mentioned that most of them have the word dad in the title.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'm going to forgive them simply because the books are so darn great. But I'm the one in the house that knows how to use the tools. So, you know, it would be nice if the moms were sort of appreciated as involved tool wielders and power tool users in the house.
It sounds like your kids are pretty excited to tinker and to light cooking fires. Let's make that specific. Any tips for parents whose kids would rather stay inside and play video games?
Yeah, that's the nice thing about video games that a lot of kids are playing today. I have to give a thumbs up and a props to Minecraft. My 10-year-old is completely addicted to Minecraft. And as long as you achieve a balance, you know, let them have some time. Minecraft, in particular, there are some fantastic aspects to it. And I have to say, even when it's not something that is teaching them, let it go. My 10-year-old and my 15-year-old don't spend a lot of time together doing things the same. One is a teenager and one is a preteen. But when they're playing a game together, that's really some great time for them, and I let them have that. I don't get all anxious about the fact that they're playing video games.
Mm-hmm. With these months stretching out in front of us, which seems so plentiful right now, we know how quickly they go here in New Hampshire. Do you suggest focusing on like one particular project, taking on one particular book, or just freeform? What's your approach?
I'm a freeform type of gal. Yeah, the projects come and go. You can start a project and then they decide that that's just not something they want to do. And I'm a big fan of letting them quit if they really have given it a go and don't love what they're doing. Some projects will stretch over the whole summer as, you know, their interest in it ebbs and flows. Right now, my 10-year-old is in the middle of whittling a whole set of magic wands. And some of them are at his grandparents' house, and some of them are at our house. And, you know, sometimes he's interested and sometimes he's not. Forcing it, exerting your own will on their play is the fastest way to kill their enthusiasm. So let them have their time. Let them have their ebb and flow.
Can I put in my order for a magic wand? Because I could really use it.
Absolutely. I will task him on that today.
Jessica Leahy, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Well, Jessica Leahy writes about education and parenting for the New York Times and the Atlantic. You'll find a link to a big pile of fantastic ideas to get kids outside making and doing this summer and a host of other articles compiled on her Jessica Leahy website. That link, wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know, do you have any tricks to get your kids away from the computer screen and out into nature? Join the ongoing discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Want to see some bored kids? In medieval Europe, children used to spend their days in the field scaring birds away. That is just one chapter from the surprisingly fascinating history of the farmer's aid, occult symbol, and source of superstition that is the scarecrow. More on that after the break, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
Ray Bolger there from The Wizard of Oz, and a song performed by one of the 20th century's most iconic agrarian figures, the Scarecrow. Nowadays, you're more likely to see a porchside scarecrow on Halloween than you are to see one towering over a cornfield. But these lonesome figures have a long history steeped in folklore and the occult, which has been mostly forgotten. Here to share some of it with us is Lori Rotenberg, who wrote the article, Hey Man, H-A-Y, of course, The Curious Life and Times of Scarecrows for Modern Farmer. Lori, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
And nice to speak with you again. Thank you.
So you trace the roots of the modern scarecrow. When did it first appear?
We can go back really almost to the beginning of time, not of cavemen, of course, but just thousands of years ago, when agrarian life really began on small plots, people would put things up to, you know, frighten birds away. And then actually, the first scarecrows were children, and they would put them in the fields to either hit blocks of wood together or throw stones. And that was, you know, their job. But then again, farms weren't as large as they are now. And they would have been more small plots for basic sustenance, you know, daily food. So that's how it is thought it began, and then it progressed to where they would put adults out there.
Well, now, of course, we don't pay people to stay out on the fields all day. How about that sort of, you know, the straw image, the Wizard of Oz image? When did that first appear?
That started more likely in England, probably in the 1700s or 1800s, with wheat farmers, where they would use, again, putting something out in the field, you know, to scare wildlife or crows away, and using props from the land, you know, using hay, twigs, and things like that. But there was never specifically scarecrows that looked like what we have at Halloween. That sort of became a commercial idea of them. Farmers always used what was available, and sometimes they would put a rotting piece of fruit, a rotting pumpkin, a squash as the head, you know, an old hat that they would find, anything that they could salvage from the farm to use as a prop. So it could vary from anything. But if there were hay around, that would be something they would use, and thus the hay man.
Yes, that's our sort of modern American scarecrow. How has and does the look of scarecrows differ across cultures?
It can vary widely depending on what their cultural beliefs might be, their religious beliefs, or what they might bring to the scarecrow. And that can vary so widely. There's thoughts that long ago farmers, to replicate the idea of birth and death, put the scarecrow's arms out as in a cross.
Mm-hmm, like the crucifixion.
Yeah, showing the crucifixion, right. And that it was symbolic of, you know, our seasons. You know, the things come up in the spring is when scarecrows actually do go out. They go up in the spring. They're not up in the fall, which is what we think due to Halloween. But that they could reflect that belief. They could reflect in ancient times not to trespass, so thus serving, you know, two purposes, to scare away animals but also humans. But across the world right now, in Japan, they use discarded heads from, you know, dolls or mannequins, and they keep those in their rice fields. They're very unusual looking. They dress them, but you have these staid, very static faces. So that's one thing out there. In England, you will still find them using, you know, more hay and fruits and vegetables.
It's so interesting, that kind of religious iconography of the crucifix. But you also found some, you also traced some of the scarecrow's roots to the occult. How's that?
Well, that is, it comes from history again, and then from websites that study scarecrows. There's a lot of actually underground fans of scarecrows. And the idea of imagery was that they were used to kind of ward off people, but that it could be, you know, Vlad the Impaler. There's Odin and his ravens. They took things out of history, out of Greek mythology. So there's Priapus, a lot of gods of agriculture and fertility were placed in fields for pollination and things like that. So it's all symbolic. There's no really specific time or place when certain things took on a particular look. That's what's so difficult about this, is that it's just such a blend of what might be in a culture at a certain time, or what beliefs stayed within a culture.
So it sounds deeply symbolic. Do they actually work? Do they keep crows away?
They did a long time ago because the fields were smaller and, you know, birds had a fear of humans. But in speaking with the people at Cornell, you know, at the ornithology lab, they said birds have become very used to seeing humans, and especially crows, that they're really not afraid of them anymore, and they're so intelligent that they can discern a scarecrow or a still object from a human being.
Yeah, I remember speaking to somebody at the lab saying that they can actually discern individual human faces.
Yes, and you know that's very true. So a lot of it is still symbolic, but you will find younger farmers across the country still using the scarecrow. They don't want to use pesticides. They don't want to use something that's mechanical. You know, they'll build one every year and bring it out.
What about on the big mega farms that dot the countryside in the U.S.?
They're starting to use more electronic scarecrows, sound devices, vibrating devices. You know, like we have dog fences now. There are things that are similar to that. They make noise that we can't always hear that frighten the birds off.
It's so interesting. It feels like our popular image of scarecrows is having somewhat of an identity crisis. You know, we have the cheerful, almost clown-like cousins of the scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz, while others are much more macabre. Are you seeing that too, Lori?
Yes, and again, it's a reflection of thought, culture, where we are, and of art. You know, there's the gentleman I wrote about in Pennsylvania, I think he's in Bucks County, and he goes by the name of Pumpkin Rot, and he makes very dark-looking figures out of things that he finds, twigs, leaves, moss, and for him, it's just an expression of what he thinks scarecrows represent, and it's the loneliness in the field, you know, being the only one out there in the seasons, and thus, you know, this is enhanced and brought out through his work. So it's all a bit of art also, and where people might be or what they're trying to express or maybe their internal demons.
Lori, thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, and have a good day, okay?
Yes, of course.
All right, bye-bye now.
Lori Rotenberg, a Chicago-based journalist who wrote the article, Hey Man, The Curious Life and Times of Scarecrows from Modern Farmer. There's a link to read it and see some of these amazing images yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. They're up at dawn chattering, they eat your crops, they scold you from the treetops, and prey on songbirds. Yet experts consider the crow, which can use tools and recognize human faces, to be one of nature's smartest birds. And while many people do not know it, crows are hunted here in New Hampshire. Sean Hurley brings us the story.
The crow, like the rat and the pigeon, is a synanthropic species, which means they've learned not only to live alongside us, but to thrive because of us. For farmers like Ralph Ratchin, who grows sweet corn, blueberries, and squash on his farm in Sanbrington, the crow is nothing but trouble.
5:30 in the morning, it's the first sound I hear out getting out of bed. And I've come around the porch many days with a loaded shotgun, but as soon as they see you, they fly away.
And that's why Ratchin came to the Owl Brook Hunter Education Center in Holderness to learn from crow hunting expert Pete Lester how to protect his crops.
How smart are crows? Smarter than most hunters. They're a very canny and intelligent animal, and that's what can make them difficult to hunt for those of you that have tried and had some limited success.
The 20 people in attendance nod in agreement. Mike Powell from Laconia, an avid hunter, says the crow has him stymied.
One of the things I came here to learn was the actual calling. How do you get them to come in? Because they are smart birds. It's amazing. I play around with them, and I can't get them to come close. So I was like, what am I doing wrong? So that's why I'm here.
To hunt the crow, Lester says, you have to know the crow. Concealment is important, hiding behind brush or in a blind. Like airplanes, crows land into the breeze, so having the wind at your back, a contrary position for most hunters, is key. But the trickiest part is getting the crow's attention. To do this, you need to learn their language.
Crows that have separated at night and have roosted are now looking for each other as they start to wake up. Where are you? I want to go get something to eat. Do you want to go with me? I mean, I'm sure that's what they're saying. But what you'll commonly hear are 3 and 4 long notes. You'll tell me I haven't heard that? You hear that early in the morning? That's one crow looking for another. If you do that, he's probably going to come looking for you.
What's hard to know is exactly who's looking for the crows. Anyone with a valid hunting license can shoot them. Unlike deer or grouse, there's no bag limit. But that's not really what troubles John Marzloff, professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington.
I mean, I'm a hunter. I'm a fisherman. And I have no problem with hunting. But crow hunting is very different. Crows are killed and they're just left or piled up sometimes. It's not the typical hunting where you're out to gather a resource which you can enjoy and eat, although I'll tell you, they taste great.
In his second book on the great-tasting bird, The Gift of Crows and Ravens, Marzloff elaborates on our long-standing, complicated relationship with the crow.
That bird is often revered as the creator or the bringer of life and also the taker of life and the trickster and the pain in the butt of all birds. So they are viewed very strongly, positively and negatively, even in the same society.
Pete Lester has never tasted crow and doesn't plan to. Regardless, he says crow hunting is completely within the range of the sport.
All right, why do you hunt crows? There are a lot of reasons. But make no apologies for being a hunter. Hunters are part of nature. A farmer might have a reason that a couple of guys in the back room don't, but they still want to do it.
Wanting to do it and doing it successfully are two different things. Even armed with Pete Lester's tips, Marshall McGurk of Walpole still isn't confident he has an advantage over the crows.
A lot of other animals won't catch you moving as quick as a crow does. If you're in a tree stand, a deer will walk right under your tree or even walk up to you if you're sitting on the ground. A crow sees you and is gone before you even realize that they were there.
For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's much more to hear and to share at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to follow us and send us your feedback or join the discussions now going on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.